Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello, I'm Leslie Kerwin. Welcome to Business Daily. Coming up, one of the world's richest men tells us how he did it.
When I was born, I was wired in a certain way. It works wonderfully in a big capitalist society, but I get paid off enormously. No great credit to me.
And his daughter explains why he buys cars which have been dented by hailstones.
They don't look hail damaged because they fix them, but because they've been hail damaged, they're cheaper. What better deal can you get?
That's all in Business Daily from the BBC. Warren Buffett is known as the Sage of Omaha. With a fortune of $40 billion, he is one of the world's wealthiest men. At the age of nearly 80, he still leads his investment company, Berkshire Hathaway. He invests in every kind of business, from small house builders to the mighty US bank Goldman Sachs. And he is noted for his frugal lifestyle. He collects $100,000 a year for running Berkshire Hathaway, a drop in the ocean compared to the millions earned by many bosses. 3 years ago, he said he was giving away the bulk of his fortune to charity. You might argue he is the acceptable face of the filthy rich. For a man who doesn't seek publicity, his rather unconventional personal life has attracted a fair amount of attention in the past. Well, Warren Buffett doesn't do many interviews, but he has talked to my colleague, the BBC's Evan Davis. We'll hear that in a minute or two, but first, I asked Evan for his impressions of the Oracle of Omaha.
He's very down to earth. He's incredibly normal. He's very easygoing. I'll give you an example. He turns up and does an hour and a half of interviewing, an hour and a half to 2 hours with us, with no public relations person in tow telling him what to say or protecting him. So a very straightforward guy who I think appears, in the small amount of private time I've had with him, appears to be very like the public persona. You know, generous, easygoing, and very honest and open.
Now, as one of the richest men on earth, does he have a lifestyle to suit that wealth?
Well, this is what is so special about Warren Buffett. Yes, he does have a private jet. He called it the indefensible. And when it comes to his car, well, he's not someone who has a Lamborghini or any flash sports cars or a Maybach Rolls-Royce or anything like that. No, his daughter buys him a car. And his daughter, Susie, explained to me that he doesn't want a car that's too flash, so she gets one that discounted because it's been damaged by hail.
Yeah, I've bought his last three or four cars. And you have to understand, he keeps cars until I tell him, this is getting embarrassing, time for a new car. They don't look hail damaged because they fix them, but because they've been hail damaged, they're cheaper. So what better deal can you get?
Well, that's his daughter telling you about the car she buys him when she feels it's time for him to have a new one. It's interesting, when we were doing the interview, the sound guy who was with us, who was a local Omaha sound recorder, said he'd been down to the driving license place to renew his driving license and found Warren Buffett in the queue in front of him. I can't imagine that many people with tens of billions who just themselves go and queue at the post office or at the driving license centre to renew their licence. So there is something incredibly and charmingly grounded about Warren Buffett.
Now, some of the words that we hear about Warren Buffett, a legend, oracle, sage, guru, they've got almost a religious connotation, haven't they? Is anybody criticising him? Is anybody feel they can do?
Well, you do find people who think he's probably not as clever as the world make out. And it would indeed be hard for him to be as clever as the world often makes out because, as you say, he's treated as something of an investment god. And when you go to the Berkshire Hathaway shareholders meeting, you know, they're the people really are not shareholders, they're disciples. They listen to every word, hang on every phrase. And you do find criticisms. One of the criticisms which I explored with him is that he does break his own rules. He does go on about how he invests for the long term, but actually he does take short-term speculative bets. He plays with the derivatives, even though he's critical of derivatives. He got lots of exposure to the derivatives markets. So in many respects, life is more complicated, and the true Warren Buffett is a more subtle, ambivalent mix, perhaps, than the Warren Buffett brand would always suggest. We also managed to find people who had criticisms of particular pieces of behaviour in his past. For example, he went down and bought a company back in the early 1960s, we found out. And of course, lots of people were sacked, and you can still find people there who say Warren Buffett didn't do us much good here in this town. But by and large, most people do not have a very bad word to say of Warren Buffett. No one's discovered the secret sins of Warren Buffett or uncovered things that he's done that truly merit condemnation. But you don't find people being very nasty about Warren Buffett because he hasn't, through the years, made that many enemies.
Evan Davis. This is Business Daily from the BBC with Leslie Kerwin. Well, one of Warren Buffett's sayings is, rule number one, never lose money. Rule number two, never forget rule number one. Berkshire Hathaway in 2008 saw the biggest decline in the value of its investment since Mr. Buffett took it over in 1965. Nevertheless, if you'd trusted him to look after $10,000 of your money when he started out, you'd have earned $50 million by now. So how does he do it? Let's hear Evan's interview. First, he asked Warren Buffett about one of his golden rules. Don't speculate, invest.
An investment attitude, you look to the asset itself to produce the return. So if I buy a farm and I expect it to produce $80 an acre for me in terms of its revenue from corn and soybeans, and it cost me $600, I'm looking at the return from the farm itself. I'm not looking at the price of the farm every day or every week or every year. I'm looking at the asset. On the other hand, if I buy a stock and I hope it goes up next week because they're going to have an earnings surprise or a dividend increase or split the stock, to me, that's pure speculation. You're looking to the price of the asset to determine whether the investment is successful. When I buy an investment, I don't care whether the stock exchange closes for 2 or 3 or 5 years afterwards, because I'm looking to the business itself to produce. We bought Coca-Cola in 1988. It wouldn't make any difference to me whether there had been a quote on the stock in the 21 years since then or not. What really counts is how the Coca-Cola company does. And that's investment, and that really is not a bet.
I mean, a lot of people are effectively speculating then. I mean, a lot more people are speculating than investing.
Well, they like it. And, you know, Keynes talked about this back in the general theory. He said when speculation is, you know, the bubble on the sea of investment, you know, that's basically okay. But when the speculation becomes dominant, he said, I think the job of capital investment is likely to be ill done. He said it much more eloquently than that. But that's the idea. And the very liquidity of stock markets causes people to focus on price action. If you buy an apartment house, if you buy a farm, if you buy a McDonald's franchise, you don't think about what it's going to sell for tomorrow or next week or next month. You think about how is this business going to do. But stocks with this huge liquidity suck people in, and they turn what should be an advantage into a disadvantage.
Well, look, everybody tries to work out how Warren Buffett makes his money, right? I mean, everybody tries to sort of summarize what the secret is, and I'm going to have my go.
Okay.
So you can tell me whether I'm a million miles.
Okay, I've been telling people for 50 years, so I'm going to be very disappointed in you if you don't come up with the right answer now.
Well, it seems to me that ultimately the crowd tends to make a mistake, and the mob, if you like, tends to extrapolate trends too far and too optimistically, and they tend to leave behind and underpriced a lot of solid, valuable companies that generate the kinds of returns you've been describing year after year. So that those systematically tend to be underpriced relative to the growth stocks. Is that really the essence of the insight?
Partly. I think the big problem most people have is they've focused on the next year instead of the next decade. I don't know what's going to happen to the stock market in the next week or month or year. I haven't the faintest idea, and I don't think about it. I never have thought about it. I do think I can tell what's going to happen in a general way to a few businesses over time. And I don't have to be right about every business. There's thousands and thousands of businesses out there. And if I just understand a few of them and I stick within that area that I understand, I'm going to do fine. It was a fellow that ran IBM many years ago, Tom Watson Sr., said, I'm no genius, but I'm smart in spots and I stay around those spots. Well, that's what investment's about. Stay around the spots.
But you wouldn't apply that principle to everyday folk who aren't doing this professionally, would you? Is your advice, you know...
Oh, no, the non-professional should diversify, because the non-professional does not know that much about any one company. But a professional should know that much about some companies. The person out there just investing their money and putting aside a little bit every month and doing it for 20 years should diversify. There's no question about that.
You're an unconventional person, aren't you? I mean, in that sense, it might be right to say that quite a lot of your success comes out of just not worrying about what the crowd is saying at any one time.
you've got to think for yourself if you're a professional investor. I mean, but I'm a capital allocator. It isn't just investment in stocks and bonds. It's buying whole businesses. But you have to think for yourself. No, I when I look in the mirror in the morning, I say, how do you feel about this? And if the mirror says yes, that's good enough.
And you don't find yourself sometimes thinking, maybe I'm wrong about this, and the dot-com companies are worth a lot. They know something that I don't know about.
They probably do know something I don't know, but that's the point. If they know something I don't know, you know, good for them. There's people that may know more about cocoa beans than I know. There's people that certainly know more about surgery than I know, or about teaching than I know, or all kinds of things. I can't know everything. All I have to do is stay around those spots and work at the things I understand.
Another area where one might say you've been quite unconventional is in your personal life. Mm-hmm. Did ever people raise their eyebrows at you at the fact that you had a wife in California, you had a person you were living with in Nebraska? It was quite sort of ahead of its time. It was 60s, wasn't it?
Well, it may still be ahead of its time. I'm not advising it for other people, but it worked great because of the three people involved. But I'm sure there were people that raised their eyebrows. They didn't do it in front of me, but it didn't make any difference to me. I mean, as long as the three people that were involved were all doing very well and happy with the situation and really couldn't imagine their life being much better, you know, that was fine with me. But I'm sure that if you'd taken a poll of all the people in Omaha, I'm sure there were some with raised eyebrows. But that's fine. It keeps them entertained, and I'm doing fine.
We're not going to dwell on this, but give us a clue as to how that could work. I mean, because that is quite...
It takes people that are very secure in their own feelings and are not jealous, obviously, and where they're all getting out of the relationships what they hope for in the relationships.
Looking at the wealthy people, far less wealthy than you, of course, do you think they have the right approach to money? I mean, because I wonder whether what you teach us about money is not how to make it, but is how to value it.
Well, basically, most of the rich people in the United States, and probably the UK too, I mean, they would not have done quite as well if they'd been in Bangladesh or someplace like that. I mean, they may think they did it all by themselves, but the society has done an awfully lot for them. And if you get the chance to live very rich in the society, you really ought to, in my view, you ought to have a taxation system, but you also ought to have a personal value system where you believe that a lot of that ought to go back to the people that got the short straws in life. I mean, when I was born, I was wired in a certain way. It works wonderfully in a capitalist, big capitalist society, but I get paid off enormously. No great credit to me. I mean, you know, I just was lucky at birth. And it's nice to give me a fair amount of the benefits from that, but I shouldn't delude myself into thinking I'm some superior individual because of that.
Let's talk a little bit about this crash and the recent economic events. You famously described derivatives as financial weapons of mass destruction. Do you think, looking back on it, that they contributed to what happened?
Oh, I think they did. I don't think they're the sole cause at all, but they did because of two things. They increase leverage dramatically in a way that people can't even measure, and then they increase interconnectedness. What happens at one financial institution affects another, and system keeps trying to develop ways to insulate that connectivity and the domino effect, but derivatives increased it very significantly. And of course, just in the case of Lehman, you can trace through some of that.
Why are you dealing in derivatives? Because this is quite counter to the sort of the image we have of what you invest in. You're big into derivatives at the moment. You're very exposed. I mean, they're swamping other movements in the earnings.
Yeah, if we think some financial instrument is mispriced significantly, and that I know enough to make that evaluation, we'll buy it very occasionally, maybe sell it short, but that's not what we really do. But if I think wheat is dramatically, I never will, but if I think wheat's mispriced, I'll buy that. If I think the British pound is mispriced, I'll buy that.
So you do speculate, you see. This comes back to where we started. You will speculate.
I would regard...
Come on, you're not an owner of those derivatives. It's not no. Like your other businesses, is it?
But it's an analytical process of looking at the various economic factors that are going to affect a given instrument.
But isn't that what everybody else does? That is what the speculators do, isn't it? I mean, that's...
It may be that people do something like that. But I think if they buy an internet stock because they think that internet stocks are going to go up, that's a lot different than buying the British pound versus the dollar, because I think that the economic consequences of fiscal policies and all of that... I'm not doing that now. I'm just using that as an illustration.
I don't know if your answer is that convincing. I mean, is that right? I mean, you're making an informed and intelligent bet on a future movement of a price, aren't you?
Based on an analysis of what what governments are doing, how money is moving. It's not based on a chart action. It's not based on anything like that. It is based on looking at numbers.
When you invested in Goldman Sachs, what gave you the confidence to do that? Did you feel at that point that the system would rebound? I mean, because that was really the low point.
It was a very scary time. I mean, it was the truth is Goldman Sachs is not going to pay you 10% after tax for money and give you warrants on 5 billion of stock unless they're scared too. Everybody was scared. There were some of the largest companies in the United States that if the Federal Reserve hadn't stepped in and effectively guaranteed commercial paper, they wouldn't have met their payroll in a few weeks. Now, I did not feel we would be dumb enough, really, in a really basically prosperous country to let the misfunction of the financial engine bring down the country. But there was a time there where you wondered about that, and that was the scariest time about the time we made that Goldman Sachs investment.
But what is the taxpayer meant to make now of the fact that Goldman Sachs is, for the last few months, has been highly profitable? And in a way, the taxpayers aren't seeing much of the upside return. The company wouldn't exist if it hadn't been for them.
Well, but they wouldn't. But that's true of, you know, the local McDonald's stand. I mean, everything was threatened by that. It was a question of saving the system. And Goldman Sachs was not a particularly weak pillar in the system at all. So it wasn't like they needed to be punished. And the taxpayer has done actually quite well with the Goldman investment.
What would you like to be remembered for?
You know, I'll go with Christopher Wren on that one. I mean, again, I'll just say with Berkshire, you know, look around you. I mean, you know, what's happened with the shareholders? What's happened with the companies? What's happened with the managers? And
the money you've made or the money you've given away?
Oh, no. Not the money. The principles involved in the business and how we've conducted the business.
Warren Buffett, smart in spots, talking to the BBC's Evan Davis. Well, what do you think of the Buffett theory of investment? Does it work for you? Send us your comments. Email us through our website, bbcworldservice.com, where you can get a podcast and listen again to all Mr. Buffett's words of wisdom.
There's a BBC podcast for every area of business.
I'm Roger Hearing with the latest business news from the BBC.
From today's world business news to global trends with Peter Day.
So I've made a trip to the new China to see what impact credit crunch is having here.
And from the top of the morning.
Welcome to Wake Up to Money with Nikki Clark.
Hello, I'm Leslie Kerwin. Welcome to Business Daily.
To the bottom line.
Who makes money when boom turns to bust?
Download your choice of BBC business podcasts at bbc.co.uk/podcasts.